it's all beginning to fall into position. It's beginning to make sense now. You see, this time I'm having this date with this Finch girl. And this is a very special... Well, it's almost a mystique. It is not a school. It's a way of life. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of being. And I'm sitting there. I didn't know that, you know, a school's a school with me, and it's a Finch school. I'd heard the expression, of course, among Princeton boys that, well, the big thing on Saturday night is to pinch a Finch girl. And, you know, I put these things off to one side, and I'm sitting there with her, and it's in the Astor Bar, and she tells me she's specializing in love and marriage. This is what she's majoring in that order, incidentally, I notice. And I ask her, well, why is it they separate the two? And she arches one eyebrow. Oh, by the way, you can also specialize in that, too. This is part of the athletic program. And it's an intramural kind of thing. And she arched it beautifully there and let it quiver there for a few moments, and all the olives were there, kind of ringing there in the glasses. And I didn't know what to say much of it because, you know, I'm not used to people who major in love and marriage in college. And very interesting. I thought this, you know, things are moving along. They're good. And we got talking about, it was the beginning of the fall semester. And you know how when kids come back from school, the instructors always have them write themes on what they did during the summer. Well, at Finch, they write themes on their most interesting traumatic experience of the summer. And so she was telling me about that. And so it's all starting to fall into place there in a way. And I figured, you know, that if I... of course, she told me, too, another thing which I thought very interesting. They come to school there in the morning in cocktail dresses. Oh, yes, they wear them in the morning with these little beaver coats and the whole business. And kind of a beaver outlook on life, too. It all adds. And before they're through the sophomore class, they already have those pictures taken. The ones that say betrothed over them. And they're all ready. And another thing, too, of course, is the kind of people who are involved in that. There is the male counterpart of that. They're all ex-Lieutenant JGs in the U.S. Navy, and they're all about to join their father's law firm in Darien, either that or a small Massachusetts town just outside of Boston, within easy commuting distance of the theater district. So so we're sitting there, and I could see right away that it wasn't for me, you see, because all the while I kept... funny thing, too, there was a guy at the next table who was having trouble with his plates, and I was trying to be very romantic, because after all, you know, it's not often that one dates someone who's majored in love and marriage, and you have to measure up to that, actually. And then I was trying to be very romantic, you know, I'd had one old-fashioned, and I was starting on my... Oh, that was terrible. This guy back of me, he was trying to eat a ham sandwich with his plates. And the worst part of it is that he had those kind of plates. There's a certain kind of plates that become aggressive. And they eat ham sandwiches on their own. And it was terrible. He would stop chewing and his plates would just keep going for about 4 minutes afterwards. Yes, they just keep going there because... And I was trying to pretend... You know, it's awful when you're with a very, very official kind of person, you know, this Finch girl there, and... It's you have to measure up to it, and somehow it became my responsibility that he was having trouble with his plates. And, you know, you want to apologize for the rottenness of the world to these people. And, oh, yes. And the plates kept going, and it was a kind of a castanet effect. And in between the Muzak, I would hear this guy's beat, and he had a pretty fair beat. He was a little slow on the upbeat, but after that he'd get moving, and we're sitting there talking way back and forth, and I realize how bad was my upbringing. The shortcomings are so evident in me. After we got up and walked out, I was limping. One leg was at least 4 inches shorter than the other, just because of shortcomings alone. You know, when I hear the rest of this, it was awful, because, you know, it's I'd say about 3 or 4 times out of the year, you're reminded of just how rotten you are. And how spotty has been your education. And I kept thinking, as I'm walking along there, for some reason or other, the picture kept coming back to my mind. This chick walks and gets into the car. You know, oh, yes, nothing about Finch girls. The minute... really, the way you prove your masculinity with a Finch girl is how you catch a cab. Oh, yes, that's very important on how you do it, you know. And nothing is more futile in New York than a man out... trying to hail a cab, and he's being outploied by other males all around, you know. And especially, he's being really outmaneuvered by tall, thin girls dressed in black. who really knew how to do it. Oh, yes, it's terrible. So you develop a style. I've got a very good cab style, by the way. I've learned it from, I just go out there in my hand. Most Finch girls' hand goes up immediately when they hit the air. It's a cab world there. And they have some classrooms over there that these are for repose. They have certain classrooms that are for relaxation and for thinking and various other hard things. And they have certain classrooms that instead of having Muzak piped in, they have the sound of a cab meter. It just, you know, it's restful to them, and it gives them a sense of security, you know. So I'm sitting there, you know, and after she left, I went down to the Horn and Hardart, and I kept thinking about, the picture kept coming up before me. Are there any Finch girls listening tonight? If any Finch girls listening tonight, I would like to talk to you, dear. It would certainly be very much fun. I would like to discuss. No, I really would. There's one Finch girl, though. There is one Finch girl who listens. For all of you guys out there who wonder about this, there is one, and she feels rotten about it. And it's the truth. I used to get letters from this Finch girl who said she had to smuggle them out with the laundress, and she would mail them here. It's a very terrible address on our mail there. And a funny thing about her, she used to send me, I never told you about this, she used to send me information about it. That's why I knew about it, really knew about it. And she's not there anymore, at least I don't hear from her. So I presume she's happily loved and in marriage, in that order, I suppose. But speaking of sitting down there in the Horn and Hearted, I'm down there. It's at moments like that that you begin to dredge up the rotten past. And you examine it for what it is. You take out the old turnips in your past, and you look at the old kohlrabis. By the way, speaking of kohlrabi, that's one of the most interesting of the American myths. It's almost like the Loch Ness Monster. Are you aware of that? That you can scare up, Ed, within 20 feet right here of the control room, you can scare up 45 guys who tell you that they once used to have kohlrabi and that they haven't had it for a long time. And I have come to the conclusion that kohlrabi is a totally mythical vegetable. It's a vegetable that people used to have but no longer have anymore. It does not exist. Have you ever really seen kohlrabi? Have you? They all say it. There's one out there right now yelling. Yeah, and not one of you can tell me when you've seen kohlrabi last. Not one of you can tell me when you've seen it last. It's one of those idiotic dreams. And the kohlrabi, people keep getting confused with the kohlrabi with the white turnip and the yellow turnip and the blue glunts. But the thing is that the kohlrabi is not a real vegetable. It just doesn't. I talked to this guy I know down on the fruit stand down there, and he says, you know, it's a funny thing how that myth got started. It's connected with the Samuel Insull shell game. About the time, do you ever hear of Insull? Why is it I know about Insull? You know, there's a funny thing in American character. Maybe it's all over the world. I don't know what it is. But Insull was probably the greatest con man that ever hit America. Oh, yes, he's fantastic. In fact, he was such a big con man that Insull finally wound up owning the entire Power and Light Company of Chicago. I mean, you have trouble with the Con Ed. How would you like to have Greasy Thumb Goosick owning it? Boy, then they would really have fun on those suites, you know, when they're digging out there. Well, anyway, he owned everything in Chicago. He took everybody's money, converted it into, mink coats, converted it into daiquiris. Now, all the stuff that guys convert money into when they steal it, I don't know what it is they do with all that stuff, but he had all this money, and finally when they got him, this was the fascinating thing about it, when they finally got this guy, and they had him up on the stands, who do you think is weeping and pleading on his behalf? All the people he stole from. There was a line of widows that extended from the courtroom all the way to Winona, Illinois, 200 miles distant and back. It was a big loop, waiting to testify for wonderful old Mr. Insull. Well, of course, they finally got him. I think he stole like $9.5 million. And just when they were going to throw the horse collar on him, he took off for Greece. As far as I know, he's still there. And the widows are still in Winona, Illinois. Well, anyway, I'm sitting down on the H&H, you know, trying to figure this out after this Finch trauma. And it is a special kind of trauma. I'm sitting down in the H&H, and I keep seeing visions of a strange picture of my mother one time. I had this mother in case... Oh, yes, I keep getting nice, wonderful little letters from ladies who keep saying, Mr. Shepherd... Actually, they don't say it that way. They say, Dear Mr. Shepherd, I resent very much you referring to your mother as my old lady. Well, you know, it's funny. My mother doesn't. In fact, she's the one who always refers to herself as that. That's where I learned it, at my mother's knee. And my father, too, in the same way. So one time, my mother, this wild moment, you know, we always have the dream that we're going to get everything for nothing. Speaking of getting it for nothing, this is WOR. AM at FM, New York, and we'll be here until midnight, and we have this dream, and it's all connected up with the Finch trauma, the olives, Samuel Insull, the plates with a smile, the castanet effect, the flywheel effect, Brownian movements. It's all connected up together. You can't escape it. The parabolic equations, hyperbolic reflections, it all makes sense, you know. Do you know what? How about this? Do you know anything about hyperbolas out there tonight? Anyone want to talk about hyperbolas? About how, you know, there's the infinite. Hey, you want to talk about infinity and all that stuff and going out there? How about? Would you like to discuss triacic equations? Or or would you prefer to discuss double Jurassic equations with a quadratic effect? With it's a multiple single ray dynamic optical occlusion there. We could discuss that, too, if you want. But it's all connected, you know. It's what I'm trying to tell you, baby. You're up to your knees in it, you know. You can't escape. It's like the other day. I just couldn't help resist. You know, I just couldn't resist it the other day after that. I was on this PM East program, and I'm sitting next to this Kim Novak. She's made out of solid ivory soap, and she floats, too, I'll bet. She looks like she's got a low specific gravity. I bet she just floats up there. So anyway, she's sitting there next to me. I keep looking at her. It's funny, you know. And finally, when it's all over, she's very humble, you know, and very, very sensitive. And I kept thinking of King Kong and, you know, hanging on the side of that building there, the Empire State Building, or was it the Chrysler Building? King Kong hung on the side of a knockdown Spads. Well, she said that she believes in marriage and all that, and especially if she can, you know, they have two different houses where they live, and they visit occasionally. And so I could see, you know, she's very sensible and very sentimental type, and deeply involved with men. And so I couldn't resist it. You'd have been proud of me, Ed, that after the lights went up and the television show was over, you know, what happens? You know all those people that are so friendly on those TV shows, you see them? Well, I'll tell you, they separate. They separate like opposite polarity iron pilings, pullings, peelings, whoopings. What happens is, as soon as the light goes off, they all shoot all 90 degrees from each other, pew, like that. Because let me tell you, there's no love lost on a panel. I can tell you that. And so, pew, it goes like that. Well, Kim puts on her, I think that was a mink coat. It still had the feet sticking out of it. And it was wild. I mean, it was live mink. And so she puts them on, because, you know, then you can't pretend that it's not real. Eyeballs were rolling up around the collars. So she puts this coat on there, see, and I'm right behind her. I said, hey, and she turns around. I says, it's good to know you, Kim baby. Oh, I could not resist it, Kim baby. Well, it was funny. I got the greatest take I've gotten, you know, since that second picture that the Marx Brothers made. And it lined out past me, bounced off the wall. And somehow I felt 9 feet tall for at least 5 minutes. And I'm sitting down in the H&H. Is there anyone out there tonight? Hey, did any Fitch girls call? Hello, hello. Well, I'm sitting in the H&H. I don't know whether you ever had this experience. And I think perhaps some of you do. It's one of the greatest lessons I ever had taught me about getting things for nothing. One of those really, a true action lesson, you know? Any Fitch girls call in? I'm very disappointed. They must cut their phones off at night. I can't believe that none of them listen. I cannot believe. Hello, girls. I mean, believe me, I'm on your side. You see, what tees me off is that I can never make it in that league, honey. You know, I know a guy who knits, and he's got so much dough, all he knits is cummerbunds. And if I could, you know, you have this feeling you want to... Oh, gee, I wish I could drink martinis. You know, really look right doing it. Every time I drink martinis, my teeth start to itch. And I got one filling that starts to whistle. Oh, it's terrible. It's metal. You know, it's what the two metals get together and it whistles in a high-pitched tone. You can hear it all over the room. It's awful. You know, no wonder I drink Ovaltine. It's awful. And it also makes you sleep good, you know. So, what's the matter? What are you laughing about? I mean, it's terrible. I'm being insulated next week. They said they're going to ground me. I have to carry this chain around, you know. It's just static electricity that does it. And, you know, reaction with the alcohol and stuff, everything all together. It's with the vermouth. And, of course, the olive provides an electrolytic. And the olive, it's what the olive gets stuck back there. And the next thing you know, you got a condenser effect, and I'm a battery, and the thing starts playing. And so they gave me a chain to carry, you know. It grounds me. And you're interested in this? Okay. I always get shocks. Sometimes, you know, I stand there. I used to carry a little lightning rod around with me. And, you know, I just let it bleed off into the ceiling sometimes. I guess it's the crepe soles I've got. I'm the only guy you know that's got a crepe soled soul. And it's terrible. It's a Tom McCann soul. You know, it's awful in the world of floor shimes. So, I'm sorry. It's terrible. Well, I'm tonight is confession night. It's Monday. What do you want? So I keep thinking of my mother. Now, I want you to listen. All you kids, you listen to this now. And because it won't happen to you, you might as well know what the truth of the world is about. My mother got this letter one time, see, and she keeps her mouth pretty shut. And she got this letter. Well, it was a letter, you know. And she was pretty secretive about it. And nobody said anything about it. Nobody knew she got letters. Until one day, it was a funny bit, one day something arrives in the mail. It was a package. And, you know, it's a package. She stuck it away in the closet. And the next day we got 725 packages, which was very unusual in our family. You see, we were strictly about a three-package-a-year family. And it turns out that in each package was a dish rag. My mother had gotten involved in a dish rag chain letter. And it said, you know, it says, "Dear Mrs. Shepherd, do not break this letter. Don't break the chain. It is very bad luck. You will be struck by lightning if you do. And this is a dish rag chain letter. Send the dish rag to the fat, stout lady on the top of the list and put your name on the bottom, and if you're lucky, you will receive 16,338 dish rags. One lady in Wyandotte, Michigan, received 8,227 dish rags within 24 hours after becoming involved in this chain letter." Well, let me tell you, my mother is still getting dish rags in the mail. We received, this is the truth, that we received in the first month, we received about 20,000 dish rags. We had dish rags piled up under the sink. We had dish rags in the basement. We had dish rags up in the attic. And by the way, my mother is about a three dish rag a year mother. It's about all she needs. We had no use for the dish rags. We had dish rags out in the backyard like snowbanks. We were using dish rags to start fires with. We were dish ragged right up to our hocks, I want to tell you. And she didn't want to tell my old man, you know, and she kept pretending like she was getting presents from Aunt Teresa. Well, he knew Aunt Teresa was a nut, but Aunt Teresa was not nutty enough to send 16,000 dish rags in 2 weeks. I'm sorry, I'm offending all of you out there. 18 Aunt Teresa's now just turned over to WPAT. They're all out there, all up and down the Grand Concourse, angry ladies. You can hear their girdles creaking in the dark out there right now. You know, well, anyway, you see, the point that I'm making here is that upon realizing that my mother hit the jackpot, I found that the jackpot turned to ashes in her mouth, that she cannot stand the sight of a dish rag now. And it all backfired, and here I sit, you see, realizing, oh, speaking of that, I'm interested in, I got a great chain letter. It's about the only chain letter. Just arrived in the mail. Any of you interested? Listen to this. "Dear Sir," this is a chain letter addressed to me, but it is not really addressed to me. It just says, "Dear Sir." And it was sent to me by a chain letter addict. It says, "This letter was started in Indiana in the hope of bringing relief and happiness to tired old husbands. Unlike most chain letters, this one will not cost you any money. Simply send a copy of this to five of your closest friends who are equally tired. Place your name at the foot of the list, then bundle your wife up and ship her to the man whose name appears at the top of the list. When your name comes to the top of the list, you may receive as many as 16,173 women, and some of them will be dandies. Have faith. Don't break this chain. One man broke this chain and got his old woman back. P.S. At the date of this writing, a friend of mine had received 378 women. They buried him yesterday. But it took three undertakers 36 hours to get the smile off his face. One, two, three. Hold it there. It's Monday, you know. It's a razzle-dazzle Monday. You know, that's a great idea for a chain letter. You know, speaking of... I think the thing I dig about being alive and being with the... You know, just being here, is that one little note that runs through everybody, and it's very buried in some people, but it's always there. That one little note, you know, that's kind of making snappy, snide remarks over the shoulder. No matter what happens. I can imagine, can you imagine once in a while Pandit Nehru sitting at this marble table, and, you know, he's surrounded by all these marble people and very official people, the great thinkers, and once in a while Pandit Nehru must say to himself, I am Pandit Nehru. Wow. Whoopee. Oh, boy, am I putting it over on him. And then you get your very straight hat, you know, and you sit there and you make a profound statement. You line one out. You see, the thing about being big and important is that after a while, nobody ever questions your statements, no matter how idiotic they are and no matter how platitudinous they are considered great statements. For example, let's say, the President of the United States today said everything's going to be all right. And it's, you know, all over they read it says, I believe that we must all work and strive to get the utmost out of our lives. I believe that things are going to be all right, and I further believe that mankind is on the pathway to eventual peace. And it gets quoted. If you say, oh, they say, oh, knock it off, Charlie. You don't know what the devil you're talking about, which is true. And you wonder whether anybody does. You know? Does the president? Does Nehru? But we've got to believe somebody does, and if we don't, we're hung. Except that after you arrive at a certain point, you know, you realize that you don't. I remember one time, you realize that nobody does. Did I ever tell you about the time I saw a famous ex-president, Republican by name, who was at a big one of these things where they give out honorary degrees, and it was out in Ohio. This man has over 700 honorary degrees, I understand. He holds the intercollegiate record now at this time for active members, for active degree receivers. And I was impressed because I was on the stand there. I was sitting just back. You know, I was in that crowd, you know, that you always see back of these guys getting the degrees. And I couldn't help but watch him. And he was sitting back there waiting for his turn to come. And they were lauding him. And they were talking about, and as you graduates go forth into the world, carrying aloft the vision of the American way of life and realizing that countless Americans who have gone before you have trod upon this lonely road that knows no turning. Well, he's sitting there, you know. You've got to admit, I'm a born graduation day orator. I could just get up there with the old eyeball glazers like anybody. Really, I'm just born for that. And I feel that we who have failed to pass the torch to you, I feel that the wonderful new approach, the lively, verdant green lushness of youth will carry. Well, anyway, I'm sitting back there, and this guy is going along there, and the robes are flapping in the breeze. You know, they all wear these robes, and the robes are going, and I notice that this president is sitting there, and it's the first time in my life I've ever seen anyone actually twiddle his thumbs. This is the thing, you know, I always hear about thumb twiddling, but I never see any thumb twiddling. Do you know that one of our greatest ex-presidents is a counterclockwise twiddler? I observed that. He twiddles like mad, and it's funny. You could tell as he falls closer to a sleep form, his twiddling slows up. And then of course, as he gains attention again, as he slowly starts to swim out of that subconscious state when you're slipping into sleep, you know, and your eyeballs, oh, it's terrible to be called upon to speak when you're a president and you've fallen asleep. And you could just see, hey, you remember when you were sitting in classrooms and they're droning on and you just, you can't keep your eyes open. You know that terrible feeling is, it's like there's 14 weights just pulling them down and they're slowly closing. You open one, you open the other, you sit there. I once fell asleep in a classroom and I'll never forget it. It was a good place to fall asleep in the classroom, actually. It was an English lit class, and it was in Florida College. You don't want to hear about that, do you, with the sound of the birds and the things whistling around out there. And I slept there. You know, it's funny. I slept there for over 10 days, and they didn't even notice it. It was just like the rest of the student body there and the teachers and everyone. And anyway, it's a funny thing about the twiddling, all of it. It's all connected. And the other day, I came across this great news note, and it's an English news note. And if it kind of says it, you see, you can't get teed off completely at the world. People are always very angry with me because I don't seem to get angry enough. I cannot sit down in the middle of Times Square holding a sign saying, shame, ban the bomb, or bomb the ban, or whatever it is that they hold those signs up saying, you know, equal trivia. Or I want peace! That angry scream. I'll show you who's in favor of peace. Take this, you slob. And the next thing you know, they're slugging it out for peace. You know, So they get mad because I don't seem to get mad enough. You notice that? Well, I don't know what it is. You know, at the worst times, I keep breaking into a sort of a laugh because of the way things are. You just can't get mad. When once in a while you see something that completely negates all the rest of the dross that we live in. There's this great news note. Do you ever listen to English newscasts? Do you ever listen to the BBC? This is London calling. That beautiful phrase. Somehow there's on the BBC they use silences like we never use. And there is a certain feeling. I remember being in Nigeria, and at every night at 7 they get the BBC on the Nigerian radio stations there. It's all over Nigeria. In fact, almost in every colony, they bring it right from the home front, don't they? In fact, I know up in England or up in Canada, they get the newscast from the BBC. It's the same news, you know, that they get off of UP, but somehow it makes them feel better, and it sounds right. And especially you like that sound of the voice fading because of the short wave, and you can hear a little static in there, you know, and the sound of the Big Ben comes roaring through. And then there's a long, pregnant pause. This is London calling. Time now for the 6 p.m. news. Sir Reginald, it's a nice long pause. They have this thing. This is a beautiful news note. I could hear them reading it. London calling. Scarborough. Two girls working in a snack bar here in Scarborough complained to their boss that pulling the handles on the coffee machine added inches to their chest measurements. Millie Hardy said she used to have a 39-inch bust, and now it measures 42. Kathleen Brackley said she is now 42 and one half, and used to be 39 and one half. The boss gave them other tasks. Gillian Green was assigned to the coffee machine. Declining to disclose her measurements, she said yesterday, "If the job does that for me, if it does what it did for them, I'd be delighted." Oh, what a rotten news note. It's a pain. we have one here. You know, the reason, of course, you learn from every source, you know. My old lady up to her knees in dish rags. Of course, my father insisted on joining one where you had to send in $5, and he set the $5 in, and this was during the Depression, when $5 came hard and few between. You remember when all that jazz was going on? He sent in the $5, and you know, I will tell you this, to the last day of my father's existence, he was not allowed to forget that. Because he not only sent in the $5, but he didn't even so much as get a canceled stamp back. It just disappeared into the distance. And he kept saying, well, you sent in for the dish rags. And my mother kept saying, dish rags are not money. Another one of the basic lessons I've learned along the road of life. So, kid, if you think that your old man isn't teaching you, just remember dish rags are not money. I don't know what it means, but there it is. Somehow it used to silence my father. And it must have meant something. Now, if you come up to me and you pluck me on the elbow and say, Shepherd, what have you learned after the 4,000 years you've existed on this orb? I don't know what I could say. In fact, the only thing I could actually say really is I don't think I've learned anything because, you know, I suspect that nobody ever really, really believes anything he learns, ever. Not really. I think learning itself is a big game. I mean, what is education? But a kind of thing we keep passing things back and forth between each other about things that have no relationship. It's like wrestling your way through Schopenhauer and then having to pay the gas bill. You know what I mean? It the things we learn, how can I express it except to say that it really doesn't matter. It's as though somehow we have developed, maybe a million years ago, I don't know how long ago, but it must have been a long time ago. We developed a vast game to keep us from realizing that we're here and that we're about to die and that we're only here a very short time. And most of us have very little time to do the things or to exist, I suppose, the way existence was meant to be. You know, there is a sky out there, and there's a moon. I saw the moon the other day. It was funny. I mean, you know, just there it is, the moon. And it was a surprise, a shock. It was over 57th Street there I saw. I don't think it's still there now. It was over Henri Bendel's there. I guess that, well, maybe that might have been their moon. I don't know. But anyway, I don't know. I wonder about these things. What is formal education? What are these things we learn? These facts, these philosophies, and these I don't know. The other night I'm sitting in a restaurant, and there are two very sad people. Somehow it was one of the sad moments. These very sad ladies, very nice ladies. You know the kind of nice ladies that sort of bob their hair, you know? And they wear cardigan sweaters. And they're in a very, what is called by the French, a very uncertain age, or of a certain age, if you look at it another way. And they have kind of very thin necks and very intense looks. And they wear these glasses, you know, that they pull down and they hang on their chest, you know, the kind of glasses that have the things that go around, they put them up on your ears there. And that kind of lady. And you could see these two ladies' whole life consisted of going out to dinner with one another. And or other ones just like that, you know. And these two ladies were sitting there, and I listened. I couldn't help it because it was a seafood restaurant, you know, where they push everything close together. And when you got your elbows going on a lobster, it gets to be very on team, you know. And so they're going on the things there, and I couldn't help but hear them. And these two ladies are talking about movies. Of course, you know the kind of movies they would only talk about. It's not movies they talk about. They talk about the cinema, films. They're the ladies and the people you see. You know, there's a whole population growing up here in New York that is a very special kind of vicarious population. Now, they would never be the Doris Day fans. You know, the Doris Day fans, they would never stand in line to see a Rock Hudson picture on Saturday night in Times Square. But they have the same problem. They don't have anything to do. They have the same problem. Their thumbs are ready to twiddle. The same problem that the great mass has. And so the mass is out there, you know, they're watching TV or they go to see Doris Day pictures. What do these people do? They have the same problem. And so any night, almost any night, I'll tell you, any night really now, go up and down the East Side and you'll see them lining up outside of art film houses. Which is their Doris Day, you see. Their Doris Day is Fellini, in a sense, you know. They don't, and a few film actors they will dig, but they dig directors the way people, you know, ordinary people type, dig Rock Hudson or Montgomery Clift. And yet it's the same kind of vicarious experience, completely vicarious, and almost as vacuous, sadly enough. And so these two ladies were sitting there, and they're discussing films. That's all they discuss. Of course, you know, he's that tall, thin man, the one with the high cheekbones who's in all of Bergman's films. And they're going on and on. And I had this sad feeling that we're all looking for something to do. We're looking frantically for something to do. Until finally, almost all of what we do in our world, our existence, whatever it might be, it's kind of, I suppose you might say, it's the eternal dilemma. Whatever it is, the dilemma is, we're here. Now what? That really is the dilemma. And so, probably a million years ago, somebody discovered that he could keep himself entertained by counting the number of leaves on a tree. And then saying to the man next to him, you know, there are over 34,000 leaves on that tree. And Og says, no kidding. Gee. And he experienced a sensation of accomplishment then, the first one. And so he counted all the pine cones on a pine tree. And after that, it began to be education, you see. He told the next one how many pine cones there were. Until finally, you had this vast pastiche of things. You know, you can spend your entire life, if you want to, in the reference room or the rare book room over at the library here, if you wish to. And it's an interesting kind of vagrancy, you know. It's an interesting kind of a kind of withdrawal, and it's far more complete than any truck driver who goes to see Doris Day at 3 o'clock, in the morning some Saturday when he says, "Oh, let's take in the last movie." This is far more of a withdrawal, and yet the withdrawal on the part of all of us is almost. It's so complete now that none of us know it. And so you look at the New York Times, for example. What is the single biggest section in the Times other than the financial section? The single one section. I mean, of course, apart from the news. Well, you will find it's the theater section. Now, is the theater about art today? Oh, it's pure. It's almost completely, in its own way, Rock Hudsonville. It's the same kind of stuff that you read in the Saturday Evening Post. The same. Oh yes, it is. In fact, almost often, more often than not, worse. If you ever look at it as literature, actually see what they're saying with it, you know, and try to put the thing together in a logical form. And so there's a reason for this. You know, it's interesting that I'd be willing to bet that a man of the 19th century, if he were to return to our world, he would be astounded. I'm talking about the mid-19th century, as recent as that. He would be astounded by our hang-up on the vicarious things of life. Theater, books, these are all vicarious. You know, as much as I enjoy reading, I have to admit it's a vicarious existence. Books, the theater, of course, on the other end of the scale, television and movies and me and all the rest of this. A fascinating thing, you know. And, of course, in New York, we are hung on it far more than any other place, in the world. We like to assume that everybody else is. We like to assume that it's just as bad, say, for example, in Chicago. Well, it isn't really. Vicarious existence has reached a high form here in New York. Until finally today, no, really, till today, many people feel a vague sense of being cheated if they go to an art film on the East Side and they don't have to wait in line. Somehow waiting in line is an important part of it. It's like a kind of, it's like paying a tithe, in a sense. It's like making obeisance to some kind of God, of rightness. And so the world of Fellini and the world of Rossellini and all the rest of them, the world of Bergman, is much realer to many of these people than their own world. It becomes part of it. And of course, you go to the homes of these same people, and you will find that they are incessantly at home. If they're not reading, they're listening to LPs, both stereo and mono. And probably, really, one of the most intriguing aspects of this thing is the fact that they will often listen to LPs, and these are the people, by the way, that buy the records of guys talking. It isn't the slob, I can tell you that. He doesn't buy those records. And so in the end, all of them will sit around and listen to somebody talk. They'll put it on the LP and they'll turn it up, you know. And I suspect the day will come when you'll be able to buy a record of brilliant conversation with just three parts, you see, and you take part. You're the fourth one. And you'll sit there, you see, and they'll hire Bertrand Russell, W.H. Auden, and perhaps Santha Rama Rao. Yeah, that's always good for that crowd. They're really hung on that chick. And there's Santha Rama Rao over here, and there's Bertrand Russell, and there's W.H. Auden, and maybe for good measure we'll throw in Gregory Corso. He keeps sniffing. Well, then you sit there, you see, and they'll leave blank spaces where Bertrand Russell will say, "Well, of course, Roger, what do you feel about that old chap?" Well, your cue is old chap. He says, what do you feel about the condition of man today in respect to the Socratic idea?" You'll say, "Well, of course, I'll tell you, Bert. I think it's this way." And you'll have a time. You'll have a little stopwatch that comes with a little $2 stopwatch. It's 45 seconds. 45 seconds goes up, and there'll be a little boop. And that means get off the phone, see? Boop. And then Russell will come back. "Yes, it's a very unusual attitude you have there. I hadn't thought about it that way, actually. What do you think, W.H.? And W.H. comes, I think you're right, old chap, but... And of course, you turn this thing all the way up, and you have it in stereo, so it sounds like all four of you are sitting around, you know, eating peanuts and having little crunchy whoopies and drinking beer. And the sound of you having your conversation with your electronic friends will come drifting up through the air conditioning unit all up and down the apartment. And, you know, I mean, it's all it's all part of this. Do you want me to do Auden again for you? Or do you prefer Bertrand? Which do you prefer? Or would you rather hear somebody talking down Rabbit Hash, Kentucky? Say, "I don't know what that guy's talking about. Hey, will you please get rid of that tripe there you got on the radio?" It's pretty difficult. You know, sometimes you figure, I'll tell you what it does. It starts working up from the ankle bones. Your ankle bones, you know, are attached to your knee bones, which in turn are attached to your leg bones, which go all the way up to your head bone, if you trace it up far enough. It's called system analysis, you know. You got to keep check on your cathodes there once in a while. Make sure that they're following good.